Welcome everyone to iloverealestate.tv podcast. My name's Debna Boholt and I'm going to be talking today about things I wish I'd learned at school. Why am I doing this? Well, let me tell you. I was chatting to one of the other mums where my son goes to school, and we were talking about the curriculum and the way of teaching and all of these sorts of things. And one of the things that came up was things we wish we'd learnt, you know, years ago when we were at school. And I thought that'd be a great topic for, topic for discussion, because that's one of the great things about podcasts is that you know, I raise a topic, and what I find is with my students particularly, you know, it becomes a discussion point for the whole family. So I hope this one here is one of those type of podcasts that you do talk to your kids about and your family at home. So let's get into it. One of the first things that I wish I'd learnt at school, or maybe took notice of at school, is probably more the point, is the power of compound interest. Now, why is this so important? Well, when you really understand how interest on interest really works, it's something that you can really use to your advantage. I was looking at some charts the other day on, just putting away, say, $1,200 a year. Now, why do I say $1,200? Well, it's $100 a month. It's not a lot of money to actually be saving. So $100 a month, $1,200 a year. And if you did that for 10 years, you know, over those 10 years, effectively, you would have put away and saved $12,000. But if you were putting that money away and it was invested, and let's say it was invested in, something that was going to return you pretty well, of say 12% or something like that, which obviously you're not going to do in anything that's sticking it in the bank. But if that were the case, at the end of the 10 years, you'd actually have $21,000, not $12,000 at all. Because what happens with the interest is that you get interest on your interest. So as that interest accumulates, it starts to snowball. It's like an avalanche effect rolling down a hill. It starts off really small, but as it gathers momentum, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger. Now that's just locking things away. And the power of compound interest is incredibly useful when you really start to put it over a longer period of time. For example, let's say you started when you were first out of school. Or, you know, let's give you a little bit of time. Let's say you started when you were 25. And by 25, you're normally into a decent sort of job and you can probably save a little bit more than $100 a month. Let's say at age 25, you started to put away, say, $5,000 a year. Now, over, the lifespan of your work, say from some 25 to 65, when we're allowed to retire these days, if you were to do that, just the same amount every year, you would actually end up with over $1 million. You'd end up with $1.14 million simply by doing that. So why isn't everybody in retirement a millionaire? The answer to that is basically because consistency. People don't have consistency. If that was what you did every year, you know, that comes before holidays, it comes before, you know, life takes over, you know, before that new motorbike, before that whatever, and know that money was not touchable until you're age 65, we'll say. That's how much you'd end up with. But let's say you didn't start that at age 25. Let's say you started at age 35. What would that really mean? Well, if you put away $5,000 a year from age 35 through to age 65, your portfolio, the value that you'd have at that point, would be $602,000. So $602,000 compared to $1.1 million. And the difference to that is basically the time frame, that extra 10 years. Now, when you start really looking at that, it makes a massive difference over the lifespan of your savings. But reality is that we wouldn't necessarily just be putting away $5,000 a year, particularly in latter years, because normally in latter years, you know, we're earning more, we're more established, we've owned our own home, things like that. So you can start to actually save a little bit more. So let me give you another scenario. How much would you need to actually be putting away at, say, a 6% return? And those other figures I gave you were at 6%, which you should be able to achieve quite easily over the long term. So at 6% return, if in the early years, say you started at age 20, you put away, $360, something like that. Not a lot of money at all, so really small amount. And then even by 25, you were putting away, say, $500. Well, by the end of it, you know, if you gradually increase that, so by 35 you were saving $1,000. Now, these are not big figures, okay? These are small figures, but this is how much you're saving per month, mind you. Then, you know, by age 60, you'd actually be able, you know, possibly be putting away, say, $14,000 because you're doing salary sacrifice and a whole lot of other things. Then you would end up with over $1 million in savings by retirement. So you can actually step it up. It doesn't have to be, you know, a really big amount to start with, but so long as it's consistent. But you see, that's not where the real game is, I don't think anyway. Because the saving is great, but I think it's a percentage of your salary that we need to be putting away. And this is the next thing that I wish we'd really learned at school, and it really comes from a great book called The Richest Man in Babylon. And if you've never read the book, it's fabulous. It was written by a gentleman by the name of George Clason back in the turn of the century, from the 1800s through to the 1900s. And he was actually the guy who mapped or produced maps of most of North America. And that was his career. But it wasn't actually where he made the most of, where he spent the most of his time. And where he spent the most of his time was actually writing short stories about money management. And in the early 1900s, these were collated into a book called The Richest Man in Babylon by Penguin Books. Now, the stories were written as if it was a biblical story. So it was this mythical place called Babylon and this rich man and how he became rich, if you like. And one of the sentiments that come out of the book is to save 10% of everything that you earn. So if you really cap your, or base your savings on your income, what you can actually do is make it mandatory for yourself to save 10% of everything that you earn. And this is a great thing to start your kids off with when they're very, very little. Regardless of, you know, how much the pocket money is, if 10% goes into long-term savings, they don't miss it. You don't miss it. You know, make it a habit and teach your kids. If they can do this from the very first time they earn any money, it makes such a massive, massive difference to you know, where they're going to be in 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 40 years' time. It's just 10% of the savings, whatever that might be. So if 10% is going into savings, what you'll notice is that, you know, this will build up really quickly. Where should you put it? Well, initially it's probably going to go into savings plans, it's going to go into managed funds, it's going to go into all of those sort of things. Now, I don't find any of that particularly, enthralling. So that actually leads me to my next thing that I wish I'd learned at school, which is my third thing, and that, of course, is passive income in property. Passive income in property. Now, passive income in property means that if you can buy a property, and you can make it neutrally or positively geared. What do I mean by that? Well, basically, all of the rent that comes in, if it looks after itself, if it just takes care of all of its rates and its insurances and its mortgage payments and everything else, and it looks after itself, then that is neutrally geared. If it actually makes more than that and puts more money back in your pocket, that's what we call positively geared. So a positively geared property. So how would you do that? Well, you've got to look at different types of property for starters. You know, the ordinary property that everybody seems to sell you through the marketeers, where it's just another negatively geared property. That's not the kind of thing I'm talking about. I'm talking about a property that either is immediately or you can turn into positive or neutrally geared. And really, this property, it's better to be in the best area that you can afford and still keep it neutrally geared. So in order to do that, you've got to look at certain characteristics of property. And this really leads me to my next thing I wish I'd learned at school, and that is multiple income streams. Because if you can turn a property into a multiple income stream property where it has more than one source of income, then that's more likely to be positively geared. So whether you buy it that way or whether you turn it into something like that, then that's how you're going to get those yields up. Where you look at, you know, two lots of rent coming in for the one purchase, you might have two houses on one block. You might have a dual key. You might have a dual occupancy. You might be able to rent it out room by room. Any of these things where you have multiple income streams coming in from the one purchase is a characteristic that will be more likely that that property is going to be positively geared. So that's the thing. Now, why am I stressing that? Because if you're accumulating properties and they're looking after themselves, your money doesn't have to go into servicing the upkeep of a particular property, then you can buy more of them. And that actually leads me to the next thing that I, you know, wish I'd learned at school, and that is the power of leverage. Because the power of leverage means that you're not using your money. You're actually using the bank's money or other people's money to get out there and buy these properties. All you've got to have is a start. Now, I was looking at some figures the other day, and it was really talking about the power of compound interest as well, but when it's applied to property. Let's say you go out and you save, I don't know, $40,000. Now, at $40,000, that would give you enough money at a 90% borrowing to go and buy a $250,000 property. And that $250,000 property would get, you know, with $40,000 means that you've got enough to get into it, plus all the costs and the stamp duty and a bit of reserve left over just to be safe. So with something like that, somewhere between 30 and 40 anyway, with somewhere around that kind of money, $250,000, what does it buy you? So what did I do? I jumped on the net and I thought, okay, what can I buy for $250,000 around the country in all the states? I played with all the states. That is going to give me a property that is positively geared. And do you know how many came up? Thousands, tens of thousands of properties that met that criteria. So there's plenty around. Now, which ones do you choose? Well, obviously, you choose the ones that are going to be in the best growth area you can afford. So, you know, a $250,000 property in Timbuktu isn't exactly going to grow very well. However, a $250,000 property in Timbuktu that has a great positive cash flow, what you can do, of course, is apply the cash flow to paying down the mortgage. Alternatively, you could go and get a $250,000 property in, you know, one of the major capital cities. In fact, all the major capital cities had at least some positively cash flowed $250,000 properties. Now, they weren't all houses, I might add. Some of them were units. But even with that, they were properties that were at least neutrally geared. Now, what are you getting out of that? Well, if the property just looks after itself, but it's in a good growth area, then what you're getting is the compound interest or the compounding effect of the value of the property. So you either chase that where the passive income coming in perhaps isn't so great, but it does look after itself, or you're chasing something that's got great positive cash flow and perhaps not as much growth, but you use the positive cash flow to pay down the mortgage. Now, which one's better? Look, there are pros and cons on each side, and perhaps that's a discussion for another time. But what it does raise is the fact that, you know, you don't need a lot of money to get into a property to make that happen. So, you know, by your early 20s, if you started saving as soon as you started working, by your early 20s, everybody should be into their first house. It may not be the house that they live in, but it's certainly going to be something. And as soon as they get the leg in the door, what happens is time happens, growth happens, cash flow happens. And from there, you can compound into the next one. You keep saving as well as, you know, having this property that's growing and having passive income. Very, very soon, you'll be into the next one and the next one. And the thing is, when you have your money spread across a number of different properties, where you might have put, you know, $30,000, $40,000 into a property, it's not like having $30,000, $40,000 sitting in a bank account earning interest. Sure, that'll be great, or a term deposit or something like that, and you'll get interest on your interest if you just leave it there. But let's step out of that. Your $30,000 or $40,000 is actually earning growth on, say, $250,000. So you're not getting the gain or the 5% or the 6% or whatever growth you're getting on your $30,000, $40,000, you're actually getting it on $250,000. Now that makes a big difference, because you know, you start to compound those kind of figures and still maintain a positive cash flow property that looks after itself, you're in a very different scenario in 5-10 years' time. And this really brings me to my next thing that I wish I'd learned at school, is simply buy one property a year, every year, buy one. Imagine what situation you'd be, say you started at 20, you buy one property a year, every year through to age 30, that's 10 years worth of buying. I can tell you now, the compounding interest, if you can kick it off and you can get that compounding value and compounding process working on every single property, by age 30, you're going to be a millionaire. Absolutely. Simply by buying one property a year. It reminds me of a story, well, it's not actually a story, it's a discussion I had with a very dear friend when we were at university together. And she said to me, you know, we were talking about money and finance and this kind of stuff, and she came from a Croatian background. So her parents had immigrated to Australia, and they were, you know, born in Croatia, and she was an Australian-born Croatian. So, you know, from migrant families, they were very much concentrated on bricks and mortar and buying properties. And she was an only child. And her father said to her, and I remember sitting around the dinner table with them one day, and her father said to her in a very thick accent, he said, "You buy one property every year for 10 years, you'll be a millionaire." And it always stuck in my head. And that was her plan, to go out there and buy one property a year for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, etc., which was really what he had done. And he was a reasonably wealthy, migrant. And how was he? Well, he actually gave her a house, a fully paid-for house, when she graduated from university. And I remember thinking at the time, God, I wish my parents had done that. But, it had come from that basic philosophy. And it's consistency. I keep coming back to it. You know, you've got to be continually determined and continually consistent in what you want. So getting out there and buying a property a year is a jolly good start, particularly if you're using all of the other fundamentals that I've talked about, such as the power of leverage, the power of compounding interest, the power of positive cash flow, or at least neutrally geared properties. You know, it's going to see those young kids very, very well set up, the ones that actually get out there to make this happen. Something else that I was actually chatting to my husband about. Now, my husband is Danish, so English is not his first language. And I said to him, I said, okay, if I could say one thing, what would be the one thing that you wish you'd learned at school? And you know what he said? The power of communication and negotiation and the power of influence. Now, that seems a bit of a long-winded answer, but I had to ask him three questions to get to that. And it really struck me because it's something that comes relatively easy to me. I guess it's something that has been innate in what I've always done. I remember negotiating my first transaction at the age of about, I don't know, 4 or 5 or something or other, with my next-door neighbour to buy his old milking cow off him. He was going to send this old milking cow called Blackie. She was about 14 years old at the time, off to the knackery. Now, for those of you who don't come from the country, a knackery is the abattoir, or they send the old cattle off to be turned into pet food. And I pleaded with him that if he would just give me Blackie, then I would exchange and I would buy her off him in exchange for doing odd jobs. And I came up with a whole list of things I could do for him. And his name was old Mr. Halberstadter. I still remember him. I still remember negotiating the purchase of Blackie around the campfire from old Mr. Halberstadter. I don't know how old he was at the time, but he seemed like he was ancient to me when I was that young. But anyway, it worked. I got old Blackie, and I think she went on to have about four or five calves before she ultimately died of a natural causes. And, those calves, they continue to compound, and I bred the heifers and I sold the steers old Blackie paid for my university degree because I sold the progeny of Blackie. First of all, the thing that Blackie bought me was my piano. And I've only recently changed that old piano that I bought back when I was about 9 to a beautiful grand piano that I have now. But that original purchase, that was my first thing that I bought with some of the steers that I sold. And then the other thing, when I sold the complete herd, it actually paid for my university degree. So perhaps I should have put it into housing maybe back then, but, you know, my university degree hasn't done too badly for me either. So let's get back to this negotiation. You know, how do you teach a kid negotiation? How do you teach them to communicate? How do you teach them to persuade and to have influence? It's really leadership skills. And, you know, it's about confidence, and it's about, you know, being happy with who they are, and having the drive and the forethought to be able to see what they could do. And really, to understand this, I think you need to understand yourself first to be able to teach your kids that kind of skill. So I'm going to leave that one with all the parents out there to really ponder that for themselves, because it's something I don't have the absolute answer to, other than to perhaps sit down on a regular basis with your kids and teach them what you're learning. You know, I was talking to one of my students who's a young mum, and teaching, you know, your children to be part of what they do. Now, she's only got one child, so it was a lot easier for her than it is when you've got a tribe of them. But to actually sit down and go through, you know, when they bought a house and what they bought it for, and you know, what they were doing to the house and how much that increased the value of it. That meant that they could go and buy another house, and, you know, that made this much money, and that meant that they could go on a holiday to Fiji because that cost this much money. And it was really the understanding of value and the understanding of money. And it's something that it really does start from a very young age. And obviously, as the children age and mature, it's something that, you know, the lessons become bigger. It's actually something that I'm writing about at the moment. I've got a children's book coming out, which I hope will be out by Christmas. Don't hold me to that one, but we'll see how we go. And it's not actually a children's book, but it's a book to parents about how to teach your kids about money and, you know, about some of the things that I'm chatting about now. So that's the next thing. It's kind of a long-winded answer there, but the power of leverage and the power of just buying one property a year and making that property positively cash flowed. And then obviously as part of that comes the power to negotiate and the power to be able to cut a deal, because a lot of the value and a lot of the money that you make is actually in the buying. It's in when you buy the property and, you know, what that actually means to be able to already get a kickstart by the negotiation process. The next thing, I guess, that I learned that I wish I'd learned at school is, you know, the understanding how the banks work. Because when you, you know, it comes back to that power of leverage, I suppose, that when you understand what they want and what their little boxes are that they have to tick, then what you can do is put yourself in the position to be able to tick those boxes for them. And, you know, it's an ever-changing market. It's why I like to use my team of strategists and mortgage strategists that I have all around the country. It's actually something that I set up years ago, simply because it to teach people about the financing and the ability to be able to use financing to your advantage. Because it's not just about, can I get a loan for this? It's really about setting yourself up for 1, 2, 3 loans in the future, 1, 2, 3 deals in the future, and understanding how that whole process works so that you can achieve your objectives within a short space of time. And I guess the last thing that I'd really wish that I'd learned at school is asset protection. I mean, it's something that I'm teaching now. I'm teaching adults. I'm teaching, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70-year-olds about asset protection, because it simply isn't taught. It isn't taught enough at university. It isn't taught enough in schools. You know, why build this huge portfolio that can simply be taken away from you, you know, because of the rules and the laws in the society that we now live in? It's something that should be fundamental to the basics of getting ahead and the basics of money. So, you know, asset protection, if you want to learn more about my philosophies and strategies around asset protection, there's a whole lot out there on the internet you can jump onto. I've got a lot of information on asset protection and a whole lot of other things on my website, iloverealestate.tv. If you'd like to pop on there and understand the power of structuring. I was chatting to a chap about 6 months ago, and he was at one of my one-day events. And he came up to me and he said, do you know that if I knew what you taught me today in just a matter of a couple of hours, 3 years ago, I wouldn't be sitting here going through bankruptcy today. He said, I had a portfolio of over $11 million. And, they were great income coming from them. He said, but one thing went against me, and it wasn't even anything that he did. It was something that an employee did. And that caused a snowball reaction with a series of lawsuits and other things, and he lost the lot. And he was having to start all over again in his, mid-40s, where some of the things that I was teaching that day would have saved him that $11 million. And I hear that story over and over. The figures are different, the circumstances are different, but it's such a fundamental part of everything that we do. It's a fundamental part of the way we need to build our assets. You wouldn't go and build a house on shaky foundations, but that's what we do every day when we buy property. We don't structure them correctly. We don't have those structures correct. And the thing is, the way our taxation and our stamp duty and our laws are structured today, if you don't get it right from the beginning, it can cost an absolute fortune to fix and correct down the track. It's why you've got to get it right early, while you're building the portfolio, while you're building your wealth for the future, so that it is structured correctly, so that it is protected from lawsuits and all sorts of things. So it is something that has been my passion for a lot of years. I've been recognized as a leading expert in asset protection for over 10 years now. And it's something that I really cannot stress enough. So absolutely, that's something that I wish I had known when I was first starting out, because, in the early days, I bought property in my own name. and as do most people. And it's really a matter of correcting that and getting the foundations right. So guys, I hope that has helped. I hope you've enjoyed our little chat this morning. Maybe you can add a whole lot more to the list. If you'd like to contact me, if you'd like to send me anything, go through my website there, iloverealestate.tv. If you'd like me to discuss something on one of my podcasts, let me know as well. Now, these are all up on iTunes. You can subscribe to iTunes so that you immediately get alerted when I put up a new podcast. And I made a commitment to myself a little while ago that I was going to do one a week at least for all of 2015, or what's left of all of 2015. So I hope you're enjoying them. Let me know your thoughts. Thanks heaps for listening, and I'll catch you again at the next one. Bye for now.